HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Elizabeth Fiorino and Ann Geddes will be telling us about the Child Foundation. So if you could each introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about your work with the foundation, that'd be great.
Okay, you want to go first?
Sure. So I'm Liz Fiorino. I am a pediatric pulmonologist and also involved in medical education. My main interest in taking care of patients is in taking care of kids with rare lung disease. And through that interest over the years, I've become involved with the foundation, and now I'm on the board of the foundation. And we're a small but mighty organization, so we kind of take on a bunch of different roles. That's me. I mean, I feel like Anne is, I want Anne to introduce herself because she really embodies the heart and soul of what the foundation is.
So my name's Anne Geddes, and my son was born with a form of children's interstitial lung disease almost 20 years ago. At the time, his disease had just got its name, and it was one of the most traumatic times of my life, and the foundation became my lifeline. And because of the impact that the foundation and the other families made, I've kind of dedicated the past 20 years as a patient advocate, and also I'm really interested in the patient education portion to empower parents to be able to advocate for their children, and also to develop programs that can benefit the families living with rare lung disease. So appreciate the opportunity to talk about this today.
It's my pleasure. So for those who might not be as familiar with the disease, can you tell me a little bit about how it might impact someone?
I guess I can take it from like the medical standpoint, and then I feel like Anne, it'd be probably much more meaningful to talk about it from the personal standpoint. So children's interstitial and diffuse lung disease is unique because it's really an umbrella that encompasses, almost 200 different conditions at this point now. And with genetics, we're finding even defining sort of newer conditions as well. And I think that has implications in two ways. One, for physicians, it makes it really challenging to research because you don't just have one condition. We have sort of multiple different conditions that present in different ways. And then I think for families and for patients, the fact that there are so many different conditions, it often can lead to a delay in diagnosis and lead to a lot of uncertainty early on. And then sometimes even uncertainty once you have a diagnosis because we don't necessarily have treatments. And so I think sort of impacting in that diagnostic piece is one thing. And then another, it is a lung disease. So there's sort of a full spectrum of how patients are affected. Some will require ventilatory support from birth, so they'll have to be on a ventilator with oxygen. Some will require oxygen, and then some children who present later in life will require oxygen at that point. And I think from my standpoint, I really am very motivated to help patients sort of navigate this. And then, Anne, I don't know if you feel like you can provide a very direct experience about how this has impacted you and Grant as well.
Yeah, so as I said before, my son was born with a form of child, and he, when he was born, he required oxygen therapy when he slept at night, and we had a real traumatic experience because he refused to wear his cannula. And so I was faced with what do I do with a newborn child, being a first-time mom, not having any support, trying to get my son to wear oxygen when he wouldn't comply, and he was a baby, so you couldn't tell him why he had to wear it. And so the peaceful times that should have been time for mom and son bonding were turned into trauma and recurring trauma. And it took us almost 6 months of being hospitalized over six times before we actually got to a pediatric pulmonologist. And from there, he did a diagnostic workup, and he's like, I'm really not sure what one of these things is. I think it's one of these interstitial diseases, but we're not sure. So we need to do a biopsy. And I was a little hesitant to allow the surgeon to take a biopsy on my son without knowing if it would have a good output. So I started searching on the internet, and that's when I found the foundation. And luckily they were having a meeting a few weeks later, And I got there and I met the experts that actually defined my son's lung disease. And together we went down to Texas Children's Hospital and got a diagnosis. And we were one of the lucky ones because we got a definitive diagnosis within a few weeks of meeting that physician. There's other families within the foundation that have gone 20 plus years and still don't have a diagnosis. And their child is just getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And those are the ones that I'm here that I'm dedicated to help the most, because I just had a really short period of time of trauma, and these families are living it every day. And so the experience for child is very different depending on which end of the spectrum you are and the diagnosis, but all of them experience some form of disruption in the family, and it's a complete game changer for the parents.
So that being said, how does the foundation support things like the mental health of the family and keep them strong through those times of adversity?
Well, that's actually a timely question, because we recently were awarded a Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute award, which is building capacity for patient-centered research. And so one of the things we've been doing over the past year is really meeting with the families and talking about what specifically they need and the types of programs to support. And so we're actually going to be developing a lot of programs over the next couple of years that include a really extensive education program, as well as a peer-to-peer mentor program that has the trauma-informed care. Previously, it's been kind of informal support where we had parent networks where we could connect with parents, other parents that had similar diseases, and then we had educational events like online webinars and conferences. But we're hoping now that we have a better picture of what the parents are really needing, and through this project, we'll be able to build some sustainable programs that have direct effect within to meet the families where they are in their homes and at their hospitals.
So, for each of you, is there any success moment or story for the foundation you'd like to share stands out for you?
And I think over the past couple of years, and I think I've only been directly involved in the foundation since 2021, maybe. Although I've been referring patients and families to it for years, I think the two big successes that have stood out are collaborating on a project with Boston Children's for funding with the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative that allowed us to really start doing a lot of programming. And again, Anne was very, very instrumental in that. And then what Anne just talked about, this patient-centered Outcomes Research Institute Award for Building Capacity, which really has invigorated, so I feel like, the two key stakeholders, the patients and families, and then the clinician researchers and basic science researchers, to kind of bring them together. So I feel like even though I think the biggest potential accomplishments are in the future, these two things have really laid a ton of groundwork. And I know Anne has been with the foundation and been involved for much, has much more of a sense of the history. So I don't know if you want to comment on the moments of success that you think.
Well, I'm definitely excited about the current momentum. There's no doubt about that. But I have to honor the amount of work that's actually been accomplished with very little funding from the research network. So when my son was diagnosed in 2000, he was born in 2005, we got his diagnosis in 2006, his disease had just been defined, and there was only about three genetic disorders that were confirmed, and there were a few others that were consistently pretty well described, but there was no treatments for it. And now when you look at the known disorders and the number of diagnoses that have now been confirmed under child, it's astounding. So we come from that handful of diagnoses to all the almost 200, and although we're still working on developing treatments and better understanding of those, the progress that science has made and our research has made with very little resources has just been astounding. So that's one of the reasons why the momentum is so exciting right now, because if they were able to do that with very little support, I think with focused direction and a broader support, the sky's the limit.
Yeah, I mean, I think for child, I totally agree with Anne. For a child as a whole, not just a foundation, so I can't, this is not me as a foundation taking credit for any of this, but just the field of pediatric rare lung disease research. The we have a registry that, again, operates with really minimal funding that now is enrolling. I think the last publication was 700 patients, but now unofficially much more than that. And one of the stories that, Doctors Lisa Young, who's at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and Robin Dieterding, who's at Children's Colorado, they've really spearheaded leading the registry and then the research network. All of this is unfunded for most of the clinicians who participate. And we just had a call yesterday, and there are over 40 doctors are kind of taking part in this community. Dr. Dieterding, one of the things she always talks about, Anne was just talking about therapies that we actually have now. So we went from having no therapies then in kids who have lung fibrosis, which is something that some types of child are at risk for, sort of scarring in the lungs, which usually is irreversible. Now there are three treatments. They're not approved yet for kids, but there's still three potential treatments. And one of those treatments actually went through a trial in kids, which is really difficult to do, especially in pediatric rare lung disease and in multiple countries and during the pandemic, and it was still completed. So I feel like as a whole for like this small but mighty community, it's really a great time to be here.
Like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure. Yeah.
In this segment of our show, Hubert Van Niekerk will be giving us an update on Every Canadian Counts. So with the year a few months old now, have you seen any progress in the political world towards a national disability insurance strategy?
Yes. We've talked. I think there is. We've that our petition has been filed with clerks for the Government of Canada, so that's good. Had meetings recently with MP Karina Gould at her office in Ottawa with past executive director Bill Cowley. I think that was a positive meeting. Also had a meeting with the member of parliament, Paddy Hadju's office staff, along with Jonathan Marchand and Deirdre Guy. And I think that was also well received. We have a future meeting coming up, I think the 20th of April, with Parliamentary Secretary to Paddy Hadju's office on with Leslie Church. So we're getting meetings. We're getting, more media attention. So I always appreciate you asking me to bring things up to date.
It's my pleasure.
But I'm at the Liberal Convention right now. I just spoke to a young Liberal who's running for as Vice President of the Young Liberals. I spoke to her while I was in the lineup for registration. 100% believes right away off the bat what we're doing. That's a personal experience for people with disabilities. So everybody, I think, has some kind of connection. And, that's what else I got down here. Like I said, I'm at the Liberal Convention. I'm going to be meeting here anytime now with Member of Parliament Peter Franciscatos, just to get an update or give him an update with what we're doing.
So I'm curious, with the extreme rise in overall costs we've seen in the past few months, why is it more important now than ever to get this strategy going? Any thoughts on this?
Well, yeah, more and more people are getting disabled, right? 27% of the population now. And, there's just more and more. Actually, I see Carla Coulter out here on the floor, so that'd be nice to have a chat with her, the past disabilities minister. And she's going to be keynote speaker at the Global Leadership Exchange, which we're going to be part of. And we keep going, eh? I have a conference at Ontario Association for Developmental Education. I've been involved with them for 22 years. And we'll have a table set up for Every Canadian Counts. I'm actually emceeing that meeting.
So when you meet with the officials, what sorts of methods are you using to get the message across? I'd imagine personal stories and the success of Australia are playing a big role.
Yeah, the success and also the problems that Australia's had, so that we can learn from any mistakes that they've made. And, you know, it's at 50, I believe it's at $52 billion a year for the National Disability Insurance Scheme that they have there. So even though it may have some issues, there's a whole lot of people that are getting support that they've never had support before, and far more support than they've had before. So one of the key things there is that they have paid caregiving. So that's, you know, so many, and mostly women, are quitting their jobs, leaving their careers to become unpaid caregivers to look after a newborn or somebody else who has a disability later in life. And so they not only lose that income, they often become isolated, poor, and end up in a part of the welfare system. Whereas if they were supported, if you have paid caregiving, and you end up with that person can go back to their career, pay income tax, you create a job for another caregiver, somebody else looking after people with disabilities. And the economy is boosted two times. So every dollar in, you get $2.25 back of a program like this. That's what Australia has proven. And so it just makes not only the right thing to do, it's a win-win in the case that it's the right thing to do, but it's also good for the economy. So there's really no reason not to go for it. You look after people with disabilities and their families. You don't have the health care costs. You don't have incarceration, policing, emergency services. You know, I could go on with the things that are affected by not providing the support, and how much money we could actually save by providing support on time when it's needed.
So what are the next immediate steps for ECC, I mean, beyond just meeting with officials?
Yeah, well, the next big step is we need to, we're going to be calling larger organizations in and sit down and have a talk. Because us as an association, we can't do this ourselves. We need buy-in from other organizations. We will be meeting with, I'm in with a meeting that has large organizations with the Global Leadership Exchange in the first week of June. But I would like to get a meeting together with, you know, 8 to 10 larger organizations to also get behind this. So we need buy-in not just from the general public, but we need buy-in from large organizations and the government.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yep, thanks, Cam.
Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making a cocktail and having fun. Even when with friends, it's important to remember alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks can save a life. Then you can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Safe.
Welcome back to Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about the Child Foundation from Ann Geddes and Elizabeth Fiorino, and we got an update on Every Canadian Counts from Hubert Van Niekerk.
In this segment of our show, John Reichelin and Kathleen Ingram will be telling us a little bit about L'Arche.
So if you could introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about L'Arche, that'd be great.
Absolutely, we can. Sure. My name is Kathleen Ingram. I'm the Executive Director for the L'Arche Ottawa community, and I've been here just under a year, but really loving life at L'Arche. What about you, John?
Yeah, my name's John Richland. I'm the Chair of the Board for L'Arche Ottawa, and unlike Kathleen, I've been involved with L'Arche for going on, I guess, 30 years nearly, and within Ottawa for the last 20-some years.
So, for those who aren't as familiar with the work of L'Arche, could you take me through some of your programs and services?
Sure. Well, let me just start by saying that L'Arche in Ottawa, which is where we are based, is part of a worldwide federation of 160 L'Arche communities, and in 30-some countries. There are 30 in Canada. One of them is here in Ottawa, of course. We have communities in Toronto and Stratford and London, and many other places around the country. And what we do, essentially, is we try to create a community, a living space, where people with intellectual disabilities share their lives with people without intellectual disabilities. And our core idea is that people with intellectual disabilities have a lot to contribute to all of us, to society. They can change our lives in ways that we can't hardly imagine. And so we want to create that opportunity for them. That's what we do in Ottawa. We've been doing that for 54 years. That's what we try to do in the 160 communities around the world.
So that being said, Do you find that having folks with intellectual disabilities, spending time with those without, sort of debunks any myths or stereotypes about intellectual disabilities?
Kathleen, do you want to respond to that? You're experiencing this for the first time in a way.
Yes, I am, absolutely. And I think it definitely does. It creates an opportunity for people to experience life together, to create mutually like transforming relationships. I know that since I started at L'Arche, my experience, my opportunity to share life with people with intellectual disabilities has just been so enriched. It's been such a beautiful blessing to be able to create and have that space and learn more about each other and just how to live life together.
So what are some of the key benefits for someone with an intellectual disability to actually be a part of a community?
I mean, I think the integration into society is really important. It gives them the opportunity to feel like they belong. One of our mottos that we cling to a little bit is we're creating a community where everyone belongs, and to be able to create that space where people can feel like they're not an other, but they're just part of the family, they're part of the group, they're part of the community, and they belong fully.
Yeah, so some of the experiences we've had in Ottawa, perhaps a little bit unique just because we're in the National Capital Region, but we've had some of our members with intellectual disabilities have appeared at parliamentary commissions, getting to represent themselves, you know, rather than have somebody speaking on their behalf. And that happens in a lot in large communities where the people with disabilities are given the opportunity and supported encouraged to speak for themselves about what they need and what they value and how the larger community can welcome them and support them. So, you know, there's myriads and myriads of examples of people whose lives have been changed in that way.
So this next question is actually for both of you. In your time with L'Arche, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share? And John, you kind of alluded to the idea that there have been some successes with self-advocacy there.
Yeah, it's not just a moment, but a period of time in my life. My wife and I have, over the years, have befriended a number of people with intellectual disabilities. One of them specifically, Robert Lamoureux, lived in an institution in the early parts of his life because families were encouraged to put their children in institutions. Robert became a family friend, and he would spend like a weekend with us every month, and really transformed our family in many, many important ways. And he passed away just over a year ago, and we miss him deeply, but it's a great example of how somebody who we would not have known except for being part of L'Arche has really changed us in profoundly and important ways.
And I think even just as recently as last week, we had one of our newest core members join us at a meeting where we were interacting and talking about how to help create a better sense of community and to engage some of our younger population. And one of our core members, who's maybe a little shy, doesn't particularly engage usually quite as vocally, just really leaned in and joined into the conversation, provided some incredible insight, and gave us all lots of really great things to think about. So just even in the small wins and the moments of how people are finding space to tell their story and to use their voice.
So are there any projects or events on the horizon for L'Arche?
Oh, gosh. Yes, of course. We consistently have a number of community events. We call them just community life events, and those events are just fun things together, a couple hours on a Monday afternoon or a couple hours in the evening. And we have a schedule of those out where we can gather people with intellectual disabilities, people who live sort of in our homes, our employees, our assistants, our office staff, our board of directors, volunteers, people just in the community, friends of L'Arche who want to gather together and just hang out together and learn and maybe do an activity or listen to some music or do any number of things together. So we have those events sort of regularly throughout our yearly calendar. And then coming up soon, we have our AGM, which is a fun night event where we do all of the legal things that we need to do for our AGM, but we throw in a little bit of fun with it. And we also are engaging shortly in the Tamarack Race in Ottawa to walk together, to raise awareness, to help share our message, and to raise funds to help with our events as well. So lots on the go, always.
I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Sad truth, my friends, is these are hard economic times, times of uncertainty, which makes a project like Hubert's work through ECC maybe seem a little more like a pipe dream, much more difficult to achieve. But the fact of the matter is, setting big goals keeps us on track. The disability world in particular, having a plan, knowing what's necessary, taking steps in that direction. Once the reality is set in, once the system's in place and working, we can never say that there's nothing more we can do to support individuals with disabilities. Having something that meaningful in place will ultimately strengthen the economy. And honestly, right now, it could use a little strengthening, to be true. As a country, we should be coming together and tapping every resource that we have available. That includes a workforce of individuals with disabilities, being able to fully participate, fully engage with the community. Truth of the matter is, we're not going to solve these problems overnight, and it's going to take commitment and sacrifice from every one of us, but together, we can take steps forward, make things better, not just for folks with disabilities, but for all of us. Getting through difficult times takes something we in the disabilities world know all about, commitment. Having patience, recognizing there are going to be setbacks, there are going to be steps forward, but learning from those steps back, becoming stronger for the fact that we know what doesn't work, we can take steps towards what does. In the disabilities world, that's paramount. This understanding that we're not going to change the world overnight is key, but recognizing that we can change things, that we can grow by our failures, celebrate in our successes, and enjoy them as a community. For folks with disabilities, there's nothing more important than the idea of strength and unity. We are stronger as a united presence and a united community. That's true of every group in life. We must not look to ourselves and say, I have all the answers, and that's the only way. Let's look to one another and say, how can we support each other? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
Hey, hey, this is Thurston. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby. Yeah, keep listening.
Cheese, please, yes, cheese, please, it's so fine.
You want to listen all the time. Snarf-Dude and Daffodil will spin their hits. It's all cheesy music, they love it to bits. Well, Snarf-Dude is the man in the band. Finding cheesy music is his only plan. Daffodil is sugar, but she's also spice. She might be saucy, but she can be pretty nice. All the cheesy music they can scrounge. You'll hear the favorites in the Limburger Lounge. Playing all that is wacky, warped, and weird. Googling cheesy music is not to be feared. Celebrity slip-ups, polka, and more. There's even the stuff on the cutting room floor. There's weird instrumental.